This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not. Small country town, interesting characters, plot twists, and of course, when there are murders, there are police. The Hollow Girl is an intriguing read, just as Lynn Yowett's last book, The Silent Listener, was. So welcome back, Lynn.
Thank you, Jen. Thank you.
Once again, set back in time a bit, it's 1973. Eleanor Smith is 40 years old and she is only the 12th female detective sergeant in Victoria's police force. Her boss at Ballarat's criminal investigation unit is Cotter. How would you describe their relationship?
Okay, Cotter is a misogynistic, stereotypical male of the era. He smokes Winfields, he doesn't like women, he doesn't think women can solve murders. He throws crappy little jobs to Eleanor that insult her intelligence.
Yeah, and he thought he was a good boss because he was a bully. And
correct.
That's, yes. Eleanor has never been put on a homicide case, so in her not-so-busy time, she's done many courses, death and deceit, psychology of a criminal liar, men who kill, infanticides, the art of reading body language, calming criminals in a crisis, cold, hard statistics are just some of them. So what's the homicide case she's given?
She is finally given the homicide of a nurse working in a home for unmarried mothers set out of Horsham, so it's quite remote. And Cotter thinks, well, I'm going to throw this one to her because it's a woman who's been murdered and it's in a home for unmarried mothers and babies, and also I'll get you out of my hair.
So this nurse, Stella Chapman, she's found strapped on the birthing room table, but she died from poison.
Correct.
And that was another course that Eleanor did. The problem with poison. It's a textbook case of poisoning, swollen tongue, the remains of some white frothing in both corners of the mouth, absolute terror inscribed on the face. Well, while the medical team were there confirming the cause of death, Eleanor and her offsider, Roger Ogier, went outside to the cemetery. And that was pretty gruesome.
Yes. So the cemetery is full of gravestones and they're just grey slabs of cement sort of banged into the ground and a bit crooked, and there are weeds and there's an old wire fence surrounding it. And all of the graves have the names of babies who were born in Hereford Hall, which is the name of the home for unmarried mothers. And Eleanor and Ogier are just horrified and kind of in despair that there are so many.
How many?
About 620, I think, if memory serves me correct.
Eleanor's statistics course helped her here, and she knew that Hereford Hall had been open for 700 weeks, housing over 40 girls. Each week, 4 to 5 babies were born, so each week, one baby had died. That's over 20%.
And she knows that's far higher than the average rate of infant death. So she figures something is going on here and it's not good.
So it's Matron Denise Montague that she, who also discovered Nurse Chapman's body in this empty Hereford Hall. And Hereford Hall, we find out, because it's now a number of years and it's closing down. And here I'm going to get Lynn Yowett to read from The Hollow Girl.
Montague looked at Eleanor, chin raised again. I'm sure you, of all people, are aware that a misguided judge, in his so-called infinite wisdom, recently decided that doctors can now legally terminate a pregnancy whenever they damn well want to. She shook her head as if to shake the idea out of existence. So the women who would have come to Hereford, who would have been looked after, who would have at least given infertile couples some happiness by producing an infant for adoption, are now all running off and having abortions with barely the regard most of us give when deciding whether to have peas or beans with a Sunday roast.
as you can tell, she's a very forthright woman. Perhaps Matron Montague also thought that the contraceptive pill would, quote, push civilised society to the brink of disintegration. But she did give every girl a purple pill each night. And what did the police think it may have been causing non-perfect babies for adoption?
Correct. So Eleanor, who is, yes, quite well read and very interested in death and murder and murderers and so on, when she is standing in the graveyard with Ogier, her sidekick, she thinks of thalidomide. And she's read a lot about thalidomide, which was an anti-morning sickness medication given to a lot of women in the 50s and 60s. And the unfortunate result of taking that medication was that many children were born disfigured, primarily either lacking in limbs or with shortened or deformed limbs. But also, which not many people, I don't think, know, a lot of the babies died within hours or days of being born. So that's what drops into Eleanor's head, and she kind of runs with that for a little while.
Mm. There's also one opened case, a coffin, dug up and open.
Yes. What's in it? So a little bit later in the book, Ogier is out looking for potential murder weapon or something like that, and he and one of the other cops from Horsham discover that one of the graves has been dug up, the coffin has been lifted out, little white, sad, lonely coffin, the lid wrenched off, and of course the coffin is empty, and they decide they need to find probably the mother of that child who perhaps has come back to reclaim the remains of the child that died.
So back in the time that Harriford Hall was operating, it was the haven for girls in crisis, or not. It had very strict rules. No talking, sirens to wake up and go to sleep, and each girl had to swallow a purple pill each night. And what happened if they disobeyed?
They were punished. It was never very clear at this stage. We're looking through the eyes of one of the girls there called Marilyn. It's never entirely clear to Marilyn what happens when someone is punished. She kind of knows that it's bad, and she sees one girl who breaks one of the rules, and she's dragged up off, dragged up the stairs from the basement laundry where the girls work, and she's never seen again.
Ah, we might get to her later. When Eleanor hadn't arrested somebody with 24 hours, because it was going to be just just go in there, arrest somebody. So no murderer in 24 hours. Cotter threatened to take the case off her, give her something that wouldn't tax her pretty little brain, like vandalism in the local hairdresser. So the story is broken up between what's happening in the police investigation and back to 1961. Explain a little bit about 14-year-old Janie McAvoy.
Okay, so Jane is a very ordinary girl. There's nothing particularly remarkable about her. Even her name is quite plain and nondescript. And she discovers that she's pregnant. In fact, her doctor does, because she has no idea that she's pregnant. She doesn't know how you get pregnant, but there have been some events that lead her to some conclusions later on. But she's pregnant, and her doctor and her mother conspire and plan to have her sent away, originally without telling her, but then they do. They tell her she's going the next day. She packs a case and she's sent off to Harriford. She has a fairly traumatic car ride there, which is a little subplot, I guess, that runs along underneath everything.
The horrible Max.
Yeah, Max is not a nice character.
Well, thankfully, times have changed. Back then, being pregnant and not married certainly had social stigma. And Matron Montague had proof that, now this is another quote, unwed women who are pregnant are physically, emotionally and morally deficient. In many cases, they are also mentally defective, and that's a well-documented fact.
Yes. And in fact, those couple phrases, morally defective and mentally deficient, were very commonly used to describe these women in such a way that there could be kind of no argument about A, sending them away so that they'd be removed from society, but also B, the big thing, of course, was that they were not fit to be mothers or deemed fit to be mothers, and so that was a really good justification for removing the children or the newborn babies from them and having them adopted out kind of instantly.
And, of course, another quote, whores have babies that die. The book is divided into four murders. The last murder is also the prologue, with a description of a poisoning, a slow, agonising death. We have to read to the end to find out who was the victim and who was the poisoner. Look, there's so much in this, and it came from a woman called Beatrice.
Yes, so I'll quickly tell you about Beatrice's story. One day we were friends. She said to me, can we have coffee? I want to tell you something. We went down to the cafe, got our coffees, and she said, okay, so I have something to tell you. And when I tell you this something, you probably won't want to be friends with me anymore. Now, I don't know, my novelist's mind, I don't know. I instantly thought, she's killed someone. And I sat there waiting to hear what the terrible thing was that would ruin our friendship. And she said, when I was 15, I got myself pregnant. Interesting. And was sent to a home for unmarried mothers, had the baby and had him adopted out. And I waited for the next part of the story that would ruin our friendship. But that was it. She had just been drowning in shame and guilt and humiliation for decades. It had been over 40 years since that had occurred.
Well, thankfully, Eleanor, our policewoman, had also done the course on the myth of the perfect murder. Lynn Yowat has set her book in the not-so-distant past, when unmarried mothers were a social disgrace and sent away to have their babies who were adopted. Years later, there are murders. The hollow girl may be the perpetrator of these revenge killings. Well done. Silent Witness was wonderful, and so is this one. Thank you so much.
Oh, Lynn. Thank you, Jen. Thanks for your time, and I really appreciate what you've done. Thank you.
And we're talking about not so very long ago when those attitudes were prevalent.
Yes. Look, I'll tell you, while I was drafting the manuscript, a lot of people started saying, so what's your next book about? And I'd say, I'm setting it in a home for unmarried mothers and there are going to be murders and so on. And nearly every single person would say to me, oh, my mother, my grandmother, my aunt, my next door neighbour's aunt, they went to, and everyone would say, one of those places. And occasionally someone would say, oh, yeah, I went to one of those places. And one day one of my friends said, he was one of the babies.
Golly.
So I had this really interesting avenue of research, totally unexpected, where a lot of people very bravely told me about their experiences. It was incredible. So, yeah, definitely within living memory.
Yeah. And here's my interview with Carla Salmon. Fire. Arson. The scourge of a tinder dry country. Carla Salmon tackles the doubt and uncertainty within a community when the flames begin to rise in her novel, We Saw What You Started. So, Carla, welcome to 3CR.
Thank you so much for having me today. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your novel begins with the danger of a bushfire. It's something most Australians would be able to identify with.
Absolutely, yes. I think we've all had it connected to us in some way at some point of our lives.
But one of your protagonists here, one of the narrative threads, is Otto, and he's from California. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a logical reason why he's in Australia, but why have you included him? What does that do in terms of our understanding of fire?
Well, I wanted to explore the notion that new kids, when they arrive, are always arriving with their own experiences. And often that experience can be, you know, things that are consistent with elements and challenges that they then develop in the place that they've moved to. And so I had a bit of a play with that and I guess made it as big as I could, bringing his experiences with fire in California to his new start that was supposed to happen in Australia.
And the logical reason is because of a fire in California, they've had to relocate to family in Australia. But yes, being able to identify across continents now with this notion of bushfire, which used to be Australian, very Australian, now it's universal, global.
Absolutely.
His experience with fire in California, there's a bit of suspicion there, isn't there?
A little bit of foreshadowing there that I like to play with right from the very beginning.
Okay, and there's a reason or a possible reason why this opening you have in your novel, why the fire has started. What are some of the factors there?
Well, the boys have been on a surfing trip and they're in an area that is quite remote, and the area of the land as well is quite narrow at the point. The tide is coming in and they have to get off the beach before, you know, the tide's going to take away their four-wheel drive. So there's the time limit that's running out. And when a fire starts in the bush, then they're obviously in a lot of trouble because they can no longer use the overland track if the tide comes in.
But the reason for the fire, or one of the reasons how the fire might have started?
Well, this is all up in the air. They're not really too sure. But the suspicion initially is that it could be tourists. They're banned, obviously, for fires in that particular region. And the kids don't really know exactly why it starts, but they think it's probably just a campfire. It's not that big of a deal and it won't be too much stress.
But they've also got motorbikes, and the heat from the motorbikes could inflame things as well. So we've got that doubt and uncertainty, and you then play on that doubt and uncertainty because the situation escalates. There's a fire at the kiosk by the swimming pool. But you've added another dimension here because Otto is there. Suspicion with Otto already. And Jasper. But let's explain who Jasper is. But how did they get to the swimming pool? What were they doing? How is it so incriminating?
Well, from the very beginning, Otto arrives in this little sleepy town, Red Sands, where he joins a surf life-saving community, just trying to fit in and make some friends. He's an experienced surfer, but he doesn't know this part of our Australian culture so much. So when he joins the club, he becomes friends with Jasper, who is the popular kid. He's at the top of the food chain in the club. And so Otto thinks, you know, he's in with the right kid. However, at the beginning, of course, with the fires, that group of children are all there. And so Otto then starts to think, oh, hang on, what's actually happening? And then when there's more fires and Otto and Jasper are actually at the scene again, then there's more suspicion.
But they lose sight of each other. They've broken in to the pool to play around, which adolescents do, but they lose sight of each other. And so you've got this doubt and uncertainty starting to develop. Can we trust each other? And, of course, there's a towel that's left there. But let's look at another thread. You've got Millie as another narrative voice. Millie is Jasper's sister. But Millie, an independent young lady.
She is. She's very strong. She's confident and competitive, which is also, I guess, the challenge for her in a small town. She doesn't necessarily fit the stereotypical norms that people are comfortable with.
But who's applying the pressure about these norms, and what are those norms that she's facing?
Oh, I think, and we're still challenging all the time. And, you know, I want young girls to think that they can be competitive in a sporting field, but also for the boys to also celebrate those girls who are competitive and strong, because I think still there's the notion that women or young girls should have an element of being gentle. And if you come across knowing exactly what you want, that can sometimes be intimidating.
But the support from Millie's father is for Jasper in terms of, well, you know, we've got to make sure that the boy gets the rewards he deserves as, you know, leading the Surf Lifesaving Club. And her work life as well, what's going on there?
That's it. And that's her ideas, is that she has never quite met her father's expectations that her brother seems to get for free. And so she's quite frustrated with that.
But she's also held back by her father. Her father doesn't want her to work.
He's protective. And look, I think also, is she correct as well in her assumptions of what her father thinks? Perhaps it's also for her to explore her own insecurities and ideas, and which is why she ends up getting this part-time job and deciding that, no, she is going to be independent and do what she wants to, again, try and demonstrate her leadership ability.
Now, we also get another layer. So there's the family layer, but there's also your rivals in the adolescent domain. There's competition and a pecking order in some ways. Otto, at one point, uploads a video of Cooper's skateboarding stack. And I find this quite interesting. It's the whole digital age that I never had to face and the challenges here. Who's Cooper? Who's he associated with? What's going on there? But that digital uploading, what's happening?
Yeah, so in the town, you have the children who are part of the Surf Lifesaving Club in the under 15s. And there's, I guess, a hierarchy there where Jasper is at the king of that little ladder. But then there's the older boys. So Cooper and Leo are 2 years older. And as such, demand, I guess, the respect of those older boys. However, they don't really earn it. They're not very nice. And at the skate park where these kids are hanging out in between training sessions, there's a lot of friction there. And Cooper then tries to establish his dominance over the younger boys. And he makes a mistake. He has a bit of a stack in the skate park.
But, well, it's a rather pertinent sort of issue at the moment in terms of what's going on digital, in the digital world, and we've got legislation about who should be using it. But Otto uploads this stack, and it's a form, well, bullying or trying to even out the field, or what adolescents now have to put up with in terms of this dynamic.
And the balance of power that's constantly shifting due to, I guess, who owns the material and who is, I guess, the most skilled at gaining the followings. And so I see often as a teacher what kids will do to maintain their social positions, both online as well as face-to-face, which often they're very different personas, and yet their power is there for them.
Yeah, a power play, jealousies, rivalries, but it's now being played out in the digital world. Also, all the way through the novel, we have a series of clues, but they can be misleading. I referenced the towel at the beginning, which was found at the swimming pool where there was a kiosk aflame, a hoodie, and there's some suspicion about Jasper, but it's a sort of common hoodie from the Surf Lifesaving Club. There's a whistling sound, so it's not really a reliable sort of source of information, an accurate source of information. But what do all these clues lead people to believe? How do they start treating each other?
And yes, they do. They obviously, it builds a suspicion. And in a small town, I wanted to explore this idea that, you know, rumours aren't always true. In fact, they're often not true. Sometimes there's an element of truth in it, but it depends on a person's perspective and what they see, and then what they remember seeing often varies. So as these clues are gathered and collected, everyone makes assumptions. The new kid is blamed because I guess there's a vacuum of information around him and the suspicions of his past. And so again, they fill that vacuum with what they believe is the truth. But is it the truth?
I now want to get onto the imagery of the surf. The wind and swell became my enemy. I roll my weight to the right, leaning into the turn with the inside advantage as Jasper's board noses beside mine. With the right combination of waves and luck, I still have a chance. Feeling the drag, Jasper disappears again behind the rising green wall. The wave could be a knight in shining armour for me, but Jasper is in a position to catch it too. I'm too close. I need to power forward another few yards, or I'll miss it. I'm sort of looking at this almost as a metaphor of what they're going through, the highs and the lows, almost like a series of waves in their life.
Absolutely. And the ocean is unpredictable. And, you know, even when you're on the wave and you think that it's going to be, you know, the best ride of your life, it's still unpredictable. And so you kind of just have to go with it and trust that you will have the skills to navigate what comes next.
Sounds like life to me. But also another life issue, there's a competition, but you've juxtaposed that with a real life saving. What's the point you're making here?
I think, again, for children to get the idea that there's a bigger picture that always overplays what they think is the most crucial thing in their life in that moment. It's so easy to get swept away in, you know, the complexities of friendships when you're a teen and trying your best to maintain your social position in these hierarchies that are developed naturally, but then some kids also form them more specifically. And yet, at the end of the day, it's about being a really good human, and everything can be figure-outable if you have really wonderful people in your lives, and doing the right thing and helping us is what is most important.
Well, will Millie be acknowledged? Will Jasper remain at the head of the pecking order? Who will win the surf life-saving competition? Who is the arsonist? Well, the listener and the reader are going to have to pick up a copy of Carla Salmon's book, We Saw What You Started, and it is a Pan Macmillan release. So, Carla, thank you very much for coming in and talking with me today.
Thank you so much.
So you had an arsonist and I had a poisoner.
And, you know, who was the perpetrator? All of those sorts of things there.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.